This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. It's the final week of the year, and we are taking a look at topics we covered on Live and Learn in 2016. Conflict and war continues to dominate the world news, and the state of affairs between Palestine and Israel was something we discussed with Amit Masood, an accomplished writer, director, choreographer, scholar, and playwright. He joined Lee Chui Lin to give a first-hand account of his experience of growing up in the Gaza Strip, a place often described as hell on earth, and how he is working on humanizing the Palestinian conflict for a global audience.
You grew up in Palestine in the Gaza Strip, and you were only 6 years old when the first Intifada started in 1987. What was life like for you before that?
Life was pretty much normal in a way. Normal in the sense that it was under occupation, so soldiers were all around us. We used to see soldiers in big military boots, heavy arms and stuff like that. But it was part of life somehow. You get to learn how to live with it and you avoid the conflict points, etc. But the moment it started, it changed everything, because the first Intifada was pretty much the same as what you would call the Arab Spring right now. So people went out in the streets demonstrating for their rights and throwing stones on military jeeps, etc. So things changed and changed dramatically. So even colors changed, the colors of daylight, the colors of the sky. There were burning tires, there were smells, there were things that we'd never seen before, tanks on the streets, more shooting and more people being killed and injured. So it was a shift, a complete shift of life altogether.
How did your parents explain to you what was happening? I mean, on the one hand, I guess I'm not a parent, but to me, it's a fine line, I would imagine, between you don't want to scare your child, but at the same time, you need them to understand, look, this is happening and things have changed.
Well, in a way, they tried not to talk about it, in a sense. And that was a big mistake, in my opinion. They tried to kind of pretend that it is normal. That's what happens in an occupation situation, that's what soldiers do, and you need to avoid soldiers. Soldiers are scary. In a way, it's a bit like a lot of parents do to their children here, maybe in Malaysia or somewhere else in the world, where they kind of scare their children with the police. You know, they say, if you do something naughty, I'll get the police for you. I know a lot of parents who do that. And in a way, yeah, the same in Gaza, was that sort of like you're told to avoid the soldiers, you're told to avoid the occupation. This is what happens. It's a conclusion, in a sense. So they avoided talking about it. And in my opinion, it was worse, because we didn't sort of understand the background of it, in a sense, and how it all happened until much later, until we grew up and we went to school.
Overall, would you describe your childhood as happy despite all this madness?
Yes, of course. I mean, the Irish have a really good saying. They say hard times are the best of times, because then comedy does very well and becomes humorous somehow. The things that you remember are the good times, the good old times, as they say. Some small memories, some human touches, all of these things, they stick in your mind. So it was.
You've also written a lot about your mother, saying she was the one who held the family together during these times. How did your mother help your family cope?
Well, my mother and a lot of Palestinian mothers as well, they have to be strong. They have to hold the family together, because very often the men are more subject to abuse and more subject to being arrested by the soldiers and more subject to being sent away, etc. And therefore, a lot of the mothers in Palestine, they try to take on the role of the father as well as the mother. And they're very open-minded and very strong in their faith, in their hopefulness that the situation will change and that peace will come at some point. So that's actually the main thing, that the hopefulness, the hopeful messages that she gave us, that things will change and things will become better. She hasn't been right, unfortunately, but that's where we are.
You also wrote that the relationship between mother and son is sacred in your culture, which is, I think, a very beautiful sentiment. Could you share that with everyone?
Yes, I mean, it's an Islamic thing, it's an Arabic thing, it's a universal thing, of course, that this relationship between the son and the mother is very sacred. Of course, Freud would disagree with that and would go into the Oedipus complex and all that, but we're not going to go there. For me, and from my culture and background, you know, this, we say in the Quran, we say that heaven is underneath the feet of mothers, and that's because of the way they work so hard, in the way they dedicate their life, the way they are so selfless, the way they become, I would like to say angels. It's cheesy, I know, but it is true. It's like that being that has this, that gives you this unconditional love. It's a complete unconditional love. No matter what happens, your mother will still love you because you're part of their flesh. Of course, sometimes this doesn't happen. These things do exist.
And it happened for you.
Yes.
When and why did you move to the United Kingdom? How did that come about for you?
I went back in 2002. I left Gaza in 2002, and I went to study my postgraduate degree in English literature in London. That was the main reason why I left. But also the situation was very difficult in Gaza. The second intifada had started then, and the situation was terrible. There were bombings every day, and it was very unsafe. So I decided to go to London to finish my postgraduate degrees.
Was it easy to leave? I mean, was the process of, you know, getting into the United Kingdom the same as it would be for anybody anywhere? You apply to a school, you get it, you go?
No. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. It was very difficult at the time. It took me about 3 months to get a visa, and I had to prove to the British Embassy, well, the British Consulate Office in Gaza at the time, that I was genuinely going to study. And it took a long time to do that. But now it's almost impossible because the border is shut. You can't get in or out. So I haven't seen my family for 2 years now, and they haven't met my new daughter, my 2.5-year-old daughter. So it's far more difficult now, although before the border was a bit easier, but the visa was difficult. Now both the visa and the border are difficult, so it's impossible to go to the UK at the moment. I'm trying to get my mother to visit the UK, and it's really difficult.
Well, you left without any expectation of returning home. How did you cope with that?
Well, I didn't know what was going to happen, you know. When I left, it was 2002. The Israelis were still controlling the border on Gaza. There was this big fat soldier who sat behind a big, massive desk. He was bald, typical soldier, typical, you know, immigration officer. He just looked at me, and, you know, I looked at him, and I didn't know whether I wanted to be back or not, whether to see soldiers again, whether to see an occupier again. So it was very difficult at the time, but of course I missed the family. I knew I wanted to go back because my family are there, my parents are there. And eventually I went back in 2009 after that.
Right now, though, how would you describe the current situation in Palestine?
It's a very difficult situation because although it remains the same in terms of the political reality and the economic reality, I think the difference here is that there is a lack of hope that never existed before, particularly after the Israeli war on Gaza in July 2014, which almost destroyed any hope for most Palestinians, both in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. What is happening at the moment is Gaza is being almost buried alive. Nothing comes in or out. Well, some stuff come in and out, but with a lot of difficulties. And also the borders are shut. So it's a big prison, a big open-air prison. I haven't been able to see my family. My family haven't been able to see me. I don't have hope to see them this year or maybe the year after. I can't even plan my holidays. I can't even plan, you know, my children's summer holidays to go and spend time with their grandparents as any parent would like to plan. And yet at the same time in the West Bank, you have a situation where the settlements are growing and growing and growing, grabbing the land, and it's becoming more difficult to live in the West Bank. So the whole idea of the West of the one state solution is becoming increasingly difficult to achieve. So that hope that once existed back in the 90s when Arafat and Rabin signed the Oslo Agreement and talked about a two-state solution, it's almost gone. Well, actually, it's definitely gone from Palestinians. So it's quite depressing. That's the difference. That's the reality. So you asked me about what the situation is like. So people don't know what to expect. They're just living in oblivion at the moment, which is a shame, really. Yeah. And I think it hurts. For me, it hurts personally to see my people like that.
I saw also that you took your son to Palestine, and you talked earlier about your parents kind of not being able to fully explain the conflict to you at the time, just saying, okay, you know, this is how it is. Bringing your son back with this heritage, how did you explain what's happening to him, especially because he doesn't live there, so he's not living it day to day?
Yes, that was one of the most difficult things I had to do, actually. I took him back in 2012 and 2013. As well, so twice. He's been to Gaza twice. He is half English, half Palestinian. My wife is English, and in fact, a quarter, or well, a third American as well, because his grandmother is American. So when we went there, I mean, he loved it. He absolutely loved it because, again, back to that holiday destination thing, the weather was sunny, it was warm, it was raining in the UK. That contrast was amazing to him. The food was brilliant. You know, the family gave him so much attention, lots of chocolates and sweets, and he was the king of the house.
Nobody, he was spoiled.
He was spoiled completely. But it was very difficult for the first time. Well, first to start with, when we got to the border and we just had to wait, you know. The border was open, but we had to wait by the Egyptians. We were just waiting. And he was trying to understand why we were waiting. And, of course, he was 3 years old then. And he just had so many books and games and a portable DVD player for him to play movies. But there was an end to that, you know? And he was just getting agitated and agitated. You know, he wanted to go, and he couldn't understand why. And even as a three-year-old, believe me, he did ask why are we waiting many and many times. And then later on, 2014, he was 4.5 years old when I took him, and there were a couple of incidents when the electricity went out. And he was trying to understand why that happened. And I was trying to explain to him about the shortage of fuel, that Israel doesn't allow us to have fuel coming in through Egypt, etc. And then there were a couple of bombings from the air, and that scared him completely. That really scared him a lot. So trying to explain that to him as well. So it started back to the basics of the situation. And of course, living in London has changed me completely because I engage with my child a lot. Not that we don't do in Palestine, of course we do, but it's in a different way. You explain things differently. And I wanted to explain things to him, but I'm not sure whether he still gets it or not. But at the same time, I don't want to drill it in him. I want him to see it for himself. I don't want him, like, there is no need to explain stuff. He will soon find out. So now, for example, he's asking me to go back to Gaza, and I'm saying we can't because the border is shut. I don't need to explain anymore. He will find out later why is it shut and stuff like that. So it's better for him to go on the learning journey by himself rather than me brainwashing him in a way. And that works for everything, from my perspective, the political situation, the religious situation, everything, you know. I think it's better for children to kind of find their own way rather than to be indoctrinated.
One issue that can come up when you're trying to explain these things, I assume, these issues, is that people feel distant when things are distant. You know, when it's far away, if it's not top of mind, you're just like, well, okay, you know, it's different for you. You're from there. You have family there. There are very direct roots. But for people for whom it's just another place somewhere where people are fighting. You know, it's a hard thing to grasp. How do you convey the idea that humanity shares such problems? How do you humanize these stories and these issues?
It's a very good question, and it's one that I keep thinking about all the time. But for me, the political change and the political situation is very much like climate change in itself. If it affects one area, it's going to affect us all in some part of the world, regardless of where this is happening. This is a global world that we're living in. It's not the old sort of three-continent world that we used to live before. It's a homogeneous global world that has access through communication, et cetera, et cetera. So whatever happens in one area will affect us. And, for example, you see the conflict in Syria, for example, and the reverberations of that and what happened to in other parts of the world as well, in France and other parts. So we need to be aware of this, that actually because it's happening there doesn't mean that it doesn't concern me. I think it does. The other thing is, I think it was Nelson Mandela who said, we cannot be completely free without the freedom of the Palestinians, because it's a human rights issue. And I was talking to a friend called a South African poet called Ethel Williams, and he was talking about the fact that actually for him, apartheid never finished because it still exists somewhere else. And it just moved from here to there. And that is important to actually say to people, that if you've lived through occupation, if you've lived through colonialism, you know what we're going through. And the fact that you're not going through it right now doesn't mean that it doesn't exist or it's gone away. In fact, we should all be united in fighting it and making sure it doesn't happen to other people anywhere.
That was Ahmad Massoud, a writer, director, choreographer, scholar and playwright, sharing his experiences of growing up in a conflict zone and how he is trying to bring the story of the Palestinian conflict to the world at large. We take a short break, but when we turn our focus to another conflict zone, Syria. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture and I'm Juliet Jacobs. We are continuing with the Live and Learn retrospective of 2016, and today's episode focuses on life in conflict zones. So the war in Syria continues to make global headlines, and just last week, Aleppo, a key battleground in the war between forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad and rebels who want to overthrow him, was recaptured by al-Assad's forces. We hear now from Syrian activist Mazen al-Hamada, who spoke to me about the system of detention and interrogation that he and many of his fellow Syrians were subjected to under al-Assad's forces. He shares his story through the help of translator Salim Gandor from the Syrian Emergency Task Force. At the core, you know, the crisis in Syria, it's about human rights violations. I don't know if you're...
Absolutely. Yeah. It is that simple.
Yeah. And a group called the Commission for the International Justice and Accountability, the CIJA, they uncovered extensive documentation showing that, you know, that Bashar al-Assad was personally involved in ordering torture on a nearly industrial scale. And this was all very painfully and clearly documented in the New Yorker piece by Ben Taub. Mazen, you were featured in that article, but before we get into that, Mazen, can you tell me a bit about yourself and what was your early life like pre-war? I understand you're the youngest of 17 children.
أوشي سعد مساك جوليا وشكرا على الاستضافة الجميلة وموجه رسالة شكر لكم للمحطة تبعكم وللشعب الماليزي اللي واقف مع الشعب السوري من بداية الثورة السورية. أنا كنت أشتغل فني معدات نفطية بشركة شلمبرج.
Good afternoon, Juliet. Thank you for having me today, and thank you to BFM 89.9. I would like to thank the people of Malaysia and Malaysia for having me today and for allowing me in. Before the war, essentially, I had a normal middle-class life. I was an oil and gas engineer with Schlumberger, a French oil and gas company. I used to work on the rigs. My work took me to many countries, but essentially most of my work was based around oil and gas rigs in Syria. So I'm from a city called Deir ez-Zor, which is in eastern Syria. Essentially in 2011, what happened was a popular uprising, mostly youth asking for basic human rights. At the start of the protests, we actually didn't even ask for Bashar al-Assad to step down. We were asking for an end to torture, an end to corruption, an end to abuse. When we were afterwards faced with airstrikes, barrel bombs, mass torture, and all types of weapons, illegal weapons used against civilians shortly after the demonstration started, this is when voices started to rise, voices asking for Bashar al-Assad to step down after we were faced with such inhuman violence. So after the protests started, Juliet, I was imprisoned in 2012 for a year and 7 months. I was imprisoned by the notorious Air Force Intelligence Unit. Of course, I was there until 2014 and I was tortured almost to death, tortured physically, tortured mentally, abused. When I was released in 2014, I finally saw Syria after almost a two-year absence, and the country was basically in ashes. And I, of course, heard reports and saw people who suffered from chemical weapons attacks, phosphorus bomb attacks. And essentially, people also were telling me that Russia was now involved, Iranian militias, and of course, also extreme independent militias that were, in a sense, all revolving around the central power of Bashar al-Assad. So it was not only had I suffered for 2 years in jail, but I left jail and I saw my country in ashes.
How is it? I mean, I've only had what I've read on the internet, and a lot of people died. A lot of people were murdered. Why is it that you managed to escape death?
طبعا أنا عائلتي موجودة للآن في سجون بشار الأسد. عندي أخ طبيب وولاد أختي وأخوي الثاني والصهري. فتنا على السجن إحنا ظليت سنة وسبع شهور تعرضت لتعذيب مفرات بالكهرباء. تعرضت لتعذيب الشبح الحرق
بالمية. I still have many family members in prison. I have three brothers and two in-laws, and I don't know about their status, whether they're alive or dead. Of course, I was electrocuted. I had boiling water poured on me. I had bruising, bones broken. In a sense, I was released because I believe it was a miracle. God has given me a new life. Many other people didn't have that opportunity. I had it. My family members didn't have it. So it's a privilege to be alive today.
I guess the next question is, after you were released from jail, what did you do? You saw your country in ashes. I'm assuming you lost many family members and friends. How did you move on from there once you were released?
بعد ما طلعت من السجن ظليت ببلدي بمحافظة دير الزور. اشتغل علينا القصف والضرب والطيران. بعدين اجت داعش للمنطقة فاضطريت اني اطلع لانه صرت مطلوب من الطرفين من الاسد ومن داعش.
After I was released from prison, I went back to my hometown of Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria. Shortly after I returned, the Assad regime and the Syrian Air Force started heavily bombarding my city. Shortly after, of course, ISIS came in. They took over my hometown, Deir ez-Zor. So the situation became untenable for me because I was being hunted down on one side by Assad forces and on the other side by ISIS. So it was urgent for me to leave, and I managed to get smuggled out. Long story short, I finally reached Holland, and I believe that I was given a new lease of life and decided to become a voice for the Syrians who have been essentially forgotten and forsaken by the world. People who were tortured by the most inhumane methods, were talking about bone breaking, we're talking about rape, boiling water, acid, electricity, all sorts of terrible torture methods. And I decided to be the voice for those people. Those people are my friends. They're my cousins, my brothers. They're young people who aspire to living normal lives. So this is now my mission. My mission is to expose the inhumanity and the genocide of the Assad regime and want to make sure that they are accountable.
Mazen, I'm very sorry to ask, but I think people actually need to hear what exactly happened to you. As in, you mentioned bone breaking, you mentioned the kind of torture that you went through, but could you sort of retell an experience of the torture just so we know how cruel and inhumane they were to you?
I'm going to tell you about what was done to me and what was done to other people in front of me.
طبعا اول ما تفوت على السجن يشلحونك عار الصدر عار الثياب ما يخلونك غير بالسليب الداخلي تمام تفوتي اول ما تفوتي بس يضربونك بالبواريد بكعب البارودة يكسروها عليك وتماما في كمان طريقة الشبح بيشبحونه هيش كلبشة من هون.
As soon as you enter the prison, they'll essentially strip you naked and only keep you in your underwear. And you will immediately be hit with the cross of the gun on the head. Typically, most prisoners will already profusely bleed from the head. The second type of punishment where they'll immediately take you is they will then crucify you by the wrists. So they'll hang you to a pipe by the wrists, and the wrists can't take the weight, and it's extremely painful. And during that whole time, they're asking for phony confessions. What they'll also do is they will put a clump around the penis and they will tighten it with a screwdriver until the penis is constricted and bleeding starts. It's extremely painful. Now, while they do that, they will also sodomize you with a steel pipe. And this is, of course, something I have endured for a long time. It's extremely painful. Other methods that I have also endured and my co-prisoners have as well is pouring of boiling water on you. Of course, the infamous German electric chair, cigarette burns as well. And of course, at one point, because we have no access to showers, there's no such thing as bathrooms. We defecate in pits. At one point, I had to scratch my skin because it was itchy. It was so dirty that when you'd scratch your skin, you would actually take it off, exposing your flesh. And I'd also like to share another story that happened in front of my eyes is a 17-year-old child who was burned to death in front of us. So they took electric cables and acid and poured it on his face and on his back, 17 years old, mind you. And they left him there, of course, in prison. There is no medicine. There's no care. So what we ended up doing is taking plastic bags, dipping it in water to soothe the pain. Unfortunately, the child died that same day and he surrendered to the pain and suffering. So this was, of course, the physical torture. Then there was naturally the conditions in which we were imprisoned. They would put us in rooms that were 1 meter by 1 meter, and eight people would have to sit there. It was extremely tight. And sometimes they'd move us to a bigger room, which is approximately 12 meters by 7 meters. They would stuff about 160 to 170 people. We would sometimes stay there months to end. Every day, 2 to 3 people would suffocate to death. Then the army would take those bodies and throw them in the garbage and would tell all of us, all other prisoners who survived, this is what happens to you if you support democracy and human rights. It was demeaning. They were destroying our minds. So what I just told you happened, of course, in the Air Force Intelligence prison. Afterwards, they moved us to the infamous Hospital 601. Now, Hospital 601 is where the Caesar pictures were leaked from. So when they took us to the hospital, we expected that maybe things would be a little easier. So as soon as we entered the hospital doors, and mind you, this is a public government-run hospital, as soon as we entered through the door, they started hitting us with steel and wooden pipes on the head and all over the body. They chained us to the beds and, of course, continued hitting us. And then they told us that we had access to the bathroom once every 12 hours for 1 minute sharp. And every time we'd enter the bathrooms, there were dead bodies. Bodies of dead children, bodies of dead men and dead women. So at some point, you start losing your mind. You go crazy. You don't understand what's happening anymore. So in the end, I was really hoping that I could go back to the Air Force Intelligence prison only because the other one was a torture house. Everyone knew it. And to me, it was just difficult to accept that hospitals were turned into industrial torture houses.
And were the doctors and the nurses complicit in this as well? Were the medical personnel involved?
So yes, the nurses and the doctors were involved because they were put there by the Assad regime, mostly pro-government Alawite nurses and doctors. Few of the doctors, the ones who had any humanity left in them, would intimately share with me that they want to get out, they want to leave, they can't take it anymore. But ultimately, really, the hospitals were turned into torture houses. The first day I entered the hospital, I had to crouch in a corner, and I was severely beaten hours and hours in a row by nurses and doctors. The beating didn't stop, really. It was very severe. They bashed me on the head, in the ribs, kicked me, So yes, the doctors and the nurses that were put there by the government were involved and are involved in the torture of civilians in a public government hospital. In Hospital 601 in Damascus, every day at midnight, someone would come and read out a list of names. And by calling out those names, the person would say that you have just been sentenced to death by a government court. So someone would come in with a wooden rod that had nails stuck to it at one end. So they would go to these people and give them two blows. One blow at the top of the neck and one blow on the top of the head. Now, of course, those who survived those blows were thrown in the bathroom and died in the bathroom. This is where we were defecating and urinating. And the other ones who died, they would ask us to take their bodies and throw them in the hospital dumpster. And while we carry those bodies, they tell us, you see, if you want democracy and human rights, this is what will happen to you.
I think the issue here is that all of this was state-sponsored torture, and that I guess it's just unimaginable in scope and cruelty, and it's, I assume, still going on today.
طبعاً حكومة بشار الأسد مخابرات بشار الأسد هلا أضافوا لها الميليشيات الإيرانية وميليشيات حزب الله وزينبيون وفاطميون الميليشيات اللي جابها بشار الأسد بالإضافة للميليشيات ال
Absolutely. The torture today is still ongoing because Bashar al-Assad is still ordering that type of industrial-scale torture. And now, of course, you have all the Iranian-linked militias such as Hezbollah who are also engaging in that type of torture against innocent Syrian civilians.
What is left back home now? I mean, do you have any contact with anyone back home?
عائلتي بسوريا كلها ما في غير أنا برا أخوتي بسوريا بدير الزور اليوم عم يتعرضون لقصف روسي وقصف من قوات التحالف عائلتي الثانية
I am the only one who managed to escape Syria out of my whole family. Of course, they remain in Deir ez-Zor, which is now heavily bombed by Russian and Assad forces and hit on the other front by ISIS. I have, again, many family members who are in prison and have been in prison for years. We have no news. We assume they're dead. Many of my friends are still in prison, but the other ones who are still free and hiding, I'm in touch with them every day on a daily basis. And I usually spend about 7 to 8 hours a day on my phone trying to communicate with them to know what is exactly happening in Syria.
And what is happening? What are the people who are still, if we can even call it free, how are they still fighting whatever they can?
يعني عم يحاولون يضغطون علينا انه يعني المشكله يعني بحكي لك مثال على عائلتي مثلا يعني اليوم الطيارات اللي بالسماء اكثر من السيارات اللي بالارض.
Of course I communicate with them in order to get updates on what is exactly happening in Syria. And unfortunately in my hometown I get news such as currently there are more aircraft, fighter jets in the sky than cars on the road. And especially lately, the Russians have been on a very aggressive onslaught using chemical weapons in my hometown. They're using napalm and phosphorus bombs. So really, my family and friends have hope and ask me to put pressure on European countries, on the United States, on Asian countries, to please help us, that people are absolutely desperate and that they hope for something, for some miracle down the road.
So you are hopeful for peace? You do think that that is a possibility sometime in the future?
طبعا كنا السوريين نتمنى انه يصير سلام بسوريا تماما لكن ما في اراده دوليه للان بايجاد حل.
Of course we would love for peace and we want peace. But from what I observe and what I see today, there is no will to implement peace in the international community and there is no will to drag Assad to the International Criminal Court. For him to answer to the crimes that he has perpetrated. We all aspire to have a free, democratic Syria that will respect the rights of all religions, of all ethnic minorities. This is our dream. But the reason why I'm here today is basically we need help. And I'm here in Malaysia today because I want your help. We need your help. We need you to raise awareness. The change in Syria will only come from outside. So we certainly hope that the international community will rescue us from that murderous regime. Again, I repeat, we want peace, but the truth is peace is currently a dream for us Syrians. And as long as there's no willingness and strength in this conflict, we don't see any end to it, unfortunately. You can all see, watching the news, how Russia is bombing us from the air, from the sea. They choked us. They're destroying us. And now on top of it, you have ethnic Shia-backed militias by Iran who are involved in ethnic cleansing and are dividing the country even more. So we feel like peace is still drifting away, and peace is a dream still in Syria.
I don't quite know how to continue from this.
We can take a break. تعبت نفسيا.
I'm so sorry.
He's asking me, that's what we, every time we do this interview, it's heavy. We never get used to it. Obviously, he never gets used to it.
No. I wanted to ask how do you do it, I suppose? How do you live through the nightmares? How do you work through all the things that you've been through and still, you know, get up every day and you still smile here with me and at everybody and just keep fighting the fight? I guess what gives you
hope? I'm trying. I'm trying to go back from again.
I try to restart my life, but I always tell myself when I feel the pain that I need to be strong for all the forgotten people and all the 500,000 people who were killed by Assad. I always have nightmares about my past life, my torture. I worry a lot about my family. I don't know if they're alive. I don't know if they're surviving. Anything can happen to them anytime. But in the end, the least I can do really is to fight for the dignity of my country. Of course, inside, I'm completely destroyed. I'm not going to lie to you. My life has been ruined. And even though I smile to you today, all the torture that I've had to endure and all the suffering I've had to go through has really affected me. But again, I always tell myself, I have to stand up for my people, for my country, for our dignity. You know, never forget that we protested just for our dignity. We were asking for crumbs, right? Just respect. And, you know, this situation escalated to where it is today. And, you know, again, I smile, but inside I'm broken. No man should go through the experiences I went through. I have to be strong and I have to smile to give confidence to the people back in Syria who are suffering. I have to give them those smiles. I have to show them that there's hope. If I stop smiling, they're destroyed.
That was Syrian activist Mazen Al-Hamada sharing his very painful experience of torture under Bashar al-Assad's forces. When we return, we hear from Ryan Harris, a Malaysian volunteer who left almost everything behind to backpack around the world and eventually ended up on a Greek island cooking for thousands of Syrian refugees. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In this last week of 2016, we are revisiting interviews we aired from the year past. Today's focus is life in conflict zones. And we now hear from volunteer cook Ryan Harris, a Subang Jaya boy who ended up on a Greek island, which was the epicenter of the most dire migrant crisis in living memory, and where he ended up feeding and helping thousands of Syrian refugees. Here's Ryan's story.
Before we go into this, what were your growing up years like? I mean, you grew up in Subang Jaya, I understand.
Yes, I did. I did. I grew up in Subang Jaya, very modern family. You know, growing up as a kid in Subang Jaya, so it's exciting, you know, all the hip years with Backstreet Boys and stuff. And I think towards my middle school, you know, high school, I went to boarding school. And that's when, you know, I learned how to be, you know, separated from my parents and family. I think that contributes to, you know, me being able to travel for a long time and not, you know, being that homesick that much.
Mm-hmm. And when we were reading, we found that you spoke a lot about your failures in life. Why is that?
I think, you know, people don't really talk about it, and or people dwell too much on their failure. I mean, the way I want to talk about failure is like I want people to know that despite how many times you fail in life, your failure is not your definite, you know, period. It's a jumping point, you know. You'll do something better. Your failure, every single one of them is a redirection to something better in life. And I want to continue doing that. I want to tell people, because a lot of people are telling me that, hey, I'm stuck here. I do not know what to do. You know, I'm not sure if I'm going to come out of it. You know, I just want people to know that you'll be able to come out of it regardless whatever you think it is.
Well, yeah. May I ask, what were some of the failures that you felt were failures?
In 2012, I got kicked out from university.
Why, right? What did you do? You said something about the government.
No. Can you imagine that? No, I filled one paper. Yes, it was a government scholarship and they were pretty strict about it. And just like that, you know, I'd realized that things can just change within minutes. Mm-hmm. To me, it was just within days and, you know, I was no longer a student, you know, just because of one paper. Right. And then, you know, I dwell for that long period of time. Like, what am I going to do? I have like 15 years plan. I have 20 years plan. I'm going to buy a car. I'm going to have a house and everything. And that didn't happen. And then I realized that I could come out of it. And 2 years, 4 years later, here I am. Yes, in your studio.
Absolutely. And gastronomy seemed to have resonated with you. You decided to become a cook. How is that?
Actually, when I was at high school, I actually went to technical college. So I did study culinary arts for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows about this. You know, I don't really tell because I went to school for something different. I always love to eat. I always love to cook. And my mom is an amazing cook. And my grandmother is an amazing cook too. And we're a family of like people who love to cook and feed people. And I think that, you know, that surrounding, growing up with that surrounding can influence, you know, me, who I am. Mm-hmm. Someone who loves to cook and feed other people, I guess.
Could you chart that journey from the time you left university over the last 4 years?
When I left university, I had a blog. It was just a personal blog. I wasn't making money at all. And I started changing a travel blog because, you know, I feel like I have so much stories to tell. And slowly the blog picks up. And by the end of 2012 into 2013, it just went on. You know, back then there wasn't many travel bloggers and people were just like, hey, this travel blogger. And, you know, I was writing in English and it started picking up. I got a job at Travel Magazine and, you know, go on from there, learning from that process. And I think by the end of 2013, you know, I felt something was missing. You know, I was living like a really good life. I was out in and out hotel, high fancy, you know, high class restaurant, in and out of plane, you know, flying everywhere. But it was just something in my soul that wasn't happy, you know. There's something missing. And I went to Langkawi and that's when my life changed completely.
What happened?
I went to a hotel review. I met this lady and I hope she exists. and she told me something about what's going to happen to my life. And she said that you're going to be given a wealth or like a property, you know, that's going to change your life. And I realized that what she meant wasn't really a property. It was this journey. And she directed me to Leslie Langkawi, which is the first place I ever volunteered. I promised to stay 2 weeks. I ended up staying for, you know, about 5 months, you know, but going back and forth to that same place. And at the end of 2013, that's when Typhoon Haiyan happened. And my heart was telling me, go. And this is coming from somebody who has no idea about disaster, who's so scared about disaster, you know, who have no experience. And I applied and I got in and it all worked out. You know, money started coming in and I started getting a bit of job here that pays. And 15 December 2013, I arrived in Ormoc, Philippines. Mm-hmm. And that's when I, you know, first experienced the first hand of disaster.
Well, how did you volunteer? What did you do?
So my first disaster response volunteering was with All Hands Volunteer. It's an American-based volunteering agency that started off after the tsunami in Aceh. So I went there as a non-skilled volunteer. And basically, we do rubbling, we clear up school, we clear up buildings, we help distribute goods. And from that 1 month, I extended. I ended up staying. The first period that I stayed with them was 7 months. And I jumped from Typhoon Haiyan to Earthquake Bohol. That's when I learned how to build schools and everything and meeting a lot of people like me who just want to do something. And that was a huge learning process. And I realized I can keep continue doing this. And I went on. And it's just amazing. And without me realizing, it's been 3 years.
Mm-hmm. You got paid for all of this?
No.
Absolutely. So how did you survive?
Blog.
So you got your blog sponsored.
Yeah, it's amazing that how you can make money online. And some people couldn't believe it, but I did, you know. There was one particular client, I got paid a month's salary for a degree holder for just posting things on social media. And that's a beautiful thing. And for now, I'm a social media consultant with an agency in Malaysia. It's a small agency, very flexible. Huge shout out to them because they were keeping me, you know, my position intact while I was in Greece. And because of that, I was able to survive while doing my job, doing my volunteer job.
Before we move on to Greece, how was it difficult for you to immerse yourself with the local community? Because some people would say charity starts at home. Why did you choose to volunteer abroad?
Well, I actually started in Malaysia. I started in Langkawi. Not many people know that. I think different people have different calling and different journey that the universe set us on this path. And this is my journey, you know. It's not that I don't want to do something in Malaysia. There's amazing people out there in Malaysia doing amazing stuff. It's just that my journey is taking a different route and I'm just following my journey.
So you started with disaster areas. Yeah. And somehow you've sort of landed with championing the refugee status. How did that happen?
Ireland Kurdi. Back in August when I came back to Malaysia, I was working and I told my boss that, hey, can I work out of Rome, Italy? I want to go study Italian and study cooking. And he said, yeah. So we were planning for that. I was planning for that, you know, to set up our office there. And the photo of Ireland Kurdi went viral and completely changed my mind. And the moment I saw his photo, I started doing research and knowing there wasn't any help on the island of Kos the first time. And then Lesbos came into picture and then the whole European Union, you know, breaks out with the story. And within 3 weeks, you know, I met people online who was trying to help out online, trying to coordinate stuff. And within 3 weeks, I landed in Lesbos. I landed in Mytilene. It was just a decision that I made quickly. You know, wasn't thinking about helping the refugees at all. It was just like needing to go there and help.
What happened when you landed in the island of Lesbos?
Heartbreaking moments, I tell you. You see thousands and thousands of people walking and I kept asking myself, freaking 2015, we got the latest iPhone, we got people on the ISS, you know, up in the sky floating, and yet we have thousands and thousands of people walking trying to find safety. What are we doing? You know, I was so angry with myself, I was so angry with the passport that I was holding, you know. It wasn't right. It didn't feel right at all. And then I went to the landing spot and then I realized that this is just, you know, the next phase of their life. They're safe already on ground. They're just walking. The moment they get on that boat from the other side, it was a different story. And that was just as heartbreaking as it was to see people walking.
Describe the landing spot.
It was a beach area. There's a few landing spots. Where I was is called Skalas Kamnias. It's a northern of Lesbos. And there's another spot called Molivos and Mathamados. There's a few landing spots. And where I set up myself, it's a small fishing village with maybe more or less 50 or 100 people living there, all people, lovely community. And by the beach area, there's just about a kilometer to a beach area. And where we set out is called Platanos. And that's where we set up our camp and, you know, co-share with other people. It's a solidarity group. I'm glad I met these people because I didn't know where I wanted to, you know, plan myself. And there was a group of people who wanted to leave. And there was a kitchen that left behind. I said, I've been looking for a kitchen and I need, you know, I want to do this. And from that moment, you know, taking over that, you know, building it up to where it was in January, it was amazing to see how solidarity and support and love from around the world could just build that.
And these refugees were coming from?
Turkey. If you see where we were, you can actually see Turkey. On a really good day, you can see the minaret over the other side. And if you're really, really good binoculars, you see them, you know, being loaded up into those boats. And it's just crazy. It's just, you know, it's how it was so near. It's crazy to think that just crossing the sea is another country, another continent already.
That first experience when you saw the first batch of refugees landing on this spot, I mean, how did that make you feel?
Surprisingly, the first boat that I received was joyous, joyful. People were almost dancing, people were smiling, we were giving kids like chips, croissant and water. And I remember this particular family wanting to take selfie. And I remember this old guy, if my grandfather had been alive, he'd probably be the age of my grandfather. And he was like smiling and I shook, you know how in Malaysia that you shook your elderly's hand and you kiss it?
Yes.
And I did the same. And he pulled me and in his very, you know, stuttering voice say thank you. We're talking about a guy from Middle East who no English is trying to say thank you. And he kissed my forehead. And I was like, how could this, you know, how could media or people around the world, you know, telling me that these are terrorists? They're not. They're just people like you and me who's trying to find safety.
Mm-hmm. How did you get the kitchen up and going?
So basically, when I arrive, I have €1,000. And then people start coming in, like, hearing about what I do. And people just like, do you need anything? I say, yes, we're running out of money. We need gas. We need cups. We need this and that. And I start working out. And as a social media influencer, I realized that my social media is so powerful. I can just post it online and people could help me. And that's how we kind of get help. I post out videos. I post out stories and say, hey, I need support. We need support. You know, there was one time that we needed a van. And I post out online. Within 5 minutes, someone was like, hey, I have a van. Do you want to take it? You know, that kind of thing is amazing to
me. People in Greece.
People around in Europe, basically.
Right. Okay.
So the connection doesn't only stop in Greece. We have bloggers in Greece, local bloggers who work with brand. She's a food blogger and she can source out food. And she just came in with boxes of food, which is amazing. You know, people using their connection as best as possible to help.
That was volunteer cook Ryan Harris sharing his experiences of giving everything up to volunteer as a cook for thousands of Syrian refugees. If you'd like to listen to any or all of these interviews in full that we featured today, you can do so by downloading the BFM app on your iOS or Android devices, and you can search for the podcast there. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.